sights and sounds of a modern jet airport operation are today familiar to most Americans. Though commercial aviation is less than 40 years in being, air travel has today become the primary mode of intercity, transcontinental, and transoceanic travel. We are all familiar with the problems which the rapid expansion of air travel has given us. High noise levels in urban and suburban residential areas, tedious delays at major airports during rush hours, and on rare occasions, the loss of life due to mid-air collisions. The United States Department of Transportation, through its Federal Aviation Administration, is responsible for the control of the airways. Recognizing the growth of both passenger and cargo aviation, FAA has proceeded with evolutionary growth of systems to permit the needed expansion and alleviate many of its growing pains. We take you now to the New York Hilton Hotel for presentations on the air system and its avionic elements by government and industrial leaders in the development of new and better systems for future air transportation. Our first speaker is the Honorable James M. Beggs, Undersecretary of the Department of Transportation. Over to you, Jim Beggs.
The Department of Transportation is engaged in the process of trying to put together a transportation system for this country. It is our objective to promote a balanced transportation system, and by balanced I mean providing viable options. Historically, we have been concerned in the Federal Aviation Administration as well as the Department of Transportation primarily with the operation of the air traffic control system and, of course, with the very important aspect of safety in aeronautics. As a consequence of that, we have overlooked, I think, some of the problems which have grown up with the rapid growth of aeronautics during the 50s and the 60s. And aviation has been an enormous success, particularly in the past decade. But that very success has created great problems for the system. We now have a situation where in our major hubs, we have congestion both in the airport itself and on the airways and terminal area around the hubs. It also has provided a problem that is growing on its environmental impact. And this is very big stuff indeed these days. And with this growth has resulted some increase in the safety hazard, although it's still a very safe system. And lately, we have run into problems in maintaining the high quality of service on the airlines commensurate with the cost. And I would suggest that the major problem that we have in aeronautics is on the ground. It's connected with the airport complex, to some extent with the amount of concrete we can pour and the number of new airports we can open. It's connected with the air traffic control system, which is mostly on the ground, but which has the ground-air interface. But here we have a problem in bringing this system up to a level of automation and putting enough capital in it so that it becomes much less labor-intensive. We have a problem at the airports and facilities in getting passengers on and off the airplane, and more importantly, in moving freight in and out of our terminal areas. And of course, we have the age-old problem that's with us all the time of moving people from the airport into the city or wherever they want to go. And it turns out they want to go to a large number of different places. Airport access is a very big thing. The compound growth rate that we've experienced in the 60s, which averaged something over 13%, means that we enter the 70s with a backlog of things we must do, and yet facing in the 70s, according to the best projections we can make, about a 12% yearly growth rate. This means that we're expecting triple the revenue passenger miles in 1980 versus 1970, doubling the number of general aviation craft. And this presents a tremendous problem to us. 17 of the 21 largest hubs will surpass 7 million in plane passengers per year. These are the metroplexes, such as New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, and so forth. We're looking forward to a time, sometime in the mid-70s, the late 70s, when we start to bring STOL operations into our major hubs. We think these demonstrations will come first, followed sometime thereafter by vertical takeoff and land kinds of operations. We'll be operating the supersonic transport at the end of the decade, and probably a goodly number of years before the end of the decade. And most importantly, we see probably an explosion in the air cargo industry. As I'm sure you know, air cargo aircraft have not been a very profitable mode of operation over the past decade. However, with the Stretch DC-8 and the 707-320 cargo versions, we have aircraft which have direct operating costs as cargo aircraft of less than 5 cents a ton mile. Comparing that with the some 20 cents a ton mile that it now costs, the price of shipping air freight, you can see that there is a tremendous area here for some innovation and improvement in ground handling, in operation of these aircraft, and perhaps in setting up total operations wrapped around air cargo to lower the rates down to where they're not too much higher than truck rates. Truckers, as you know, move cargo across this country for a price of in the order of 7 cents to 8 cents a ton mile. Now, we saw a necessity to increase the federal expenditures to update the air traffic control system. The 60s saw this tremendous growth with not a commensurate investment in the air traffic control system. So we went to the Congress and asked them for a vastly increased investment on the part of the federal government in the air traffic control system and in the airports system. For airports, this act will provide about $2.5 billion in matching funds over the next 10 years. That's on a 50-50 matching ratio. And for the airways, another $2.5 billion for new facilities and equipment. And in addition to that, we intend to invest something in the order of $100 million per year in research and development to both improve the present system, present national airspace system that's currently being put into operation, and to plan ahead and get underway with our research and development for the system that must come in sometime before the end of the decade. We're going to lean very heavily on the kind of technology that came out of the space program and the military program in the last couple of decades. Recently, we published the National Aviation System Plan, the so-called Alexander Report, which details the work we expect to do in the coming decade. Now, we intend to use that report as a basis for the research and development that we undertake in the next several years. However, I expect that as time goes on, we'll find reasons to modify it. Our objectives are very simple. More automation of the system, make it capital intensive instead of labor intensive. To safely reduce aircraft separation and to find a better way to use the facilities we already have in place, the concrete that's already there. To markedly improve the dependability of the system and its components in all kinds of weather. To hopefully get to the point where we can operate in a completely zero-zero condition. And to solve the ground delay problem with better people cargo handling systems and better airport access. With all this, we've got to pay a lot of attention to the environment because noise in and around the airports has become a very important factor. We have a certain amount of air pollution associated with our aircraft operations, and this must get some attention. And we must so configure our navigation system so that we can get compatible use of the airport facilities with the surrounding land. This probably means more work on area navigation concepts and improvement in the total navigation system. So we've got to put the emphasis on the R&D, but in a way that will enable us to use the current system and improve it as we go along.
The era of short-range takeoff and landing, or STOL aircraft, and vertically maneuverable high-speed aircraft is yet to come. With these, plus high-speed ground transportation, as entries into the formula, the Department of Transportation's Balancing Act will require many innovative engineering developments. Which of these developments will produce heavy requirements in the electronics area? Harry Davis, Deputy Undersecretary for Systems Review of the U.S. Air Force, has his own personal views. Let's hear them.
I'd like to briefly retrace history, or little pieces of the history, as I recollect it. Following World War II, there was a rash of interest in electronic industries and air navigation and traffic control systems. And they just blossomed like mad. Everybody had a pet scheme. Some of you may remember Hyperan, Telluran, Navar. Well, anyway, around 1948, it was decided we had to build a system. So the Radio Technical Commission for Aviation had a subcommittee called SE-31, and we came up with a system. It was a compromise that included everything. You name it, and it had it. And that became the basis of the air navigation traffic control system we have today. If I seem to be somewhat critical, I'm critical of myself. Well, time went on, and we started to implement the SE-31, the Omni, the DME, the TACAN, the ILS, the VHF, the marker beacons, so that today, in one airplane, we have 29 antennas, 76-odd boxes to do communication, navigation, and identification. Well, let's proceed then on to about 1961, when traffic control got to be a crisis. I should say this happened in 1950, and 51, 52. Every year, traffic control is a crisis. But in 61, I single out because that year, a committee was called the Beacon Committee, which then made the recommendations that all aircraft carry a transponder with certain codes to tell altitude, air-derived altitude, and transmit it down to the ground. The Beacon Committee then was to be implemented in, I don't know, 5 years or something like that. It's still got a long way to go. Then in 1969 came the Alexander Report. And it's going to be my job to be, I think, the gadfly of this meeting and to take issue with some of the things in the Alexander Report. But let me say this, there are some good things in the Alexander Report. Again, back to 1948, one of the companies involved in designing an air traffic control system, and they looked at the air traffic control system and they said, my God, who ever heard of a railroad which has many, many lines, but then at the terminal ends into one track? Yeah, that was the airlines. One good thing of the Alexander Report is that it did point out the need for multiple runways so that you have some of the ideas where you have maybe even a single line track, but when you get to the terminals, it better fan out or you have trouble. Well, what are some of the disadvantages of the present system? First, the system has many, many separate black boxes with different modulations, different maintenance required, many antennas, none of which are completely adequate. It's difficult, except for the very large aircraft, to have redundant boxes in all of the functions. The third disadvantage of what we have now is that it is expensive. For the small aircraft, well, expensive for everybody, but the small aircraft just ignores it. And that's one of the problems. They just don't buy this beacon, which is several thousand dollars, and what with altitude encoding and other things like data link added to it, will probably add another several thousand. The systems is very inefficient in the use of the RF spectrum. Things like DME, TACAN, beacons, take megacycles of bandwidth and transmit, so help me, a bit of information on the average per aircraft. We have a big chunk of the spectrum in air navigation and traffic control. And that's about all we'll get. And we're sort of going to have to live in there, live in with a growing number of airplanes. Worldwide coverage is difficult. It depends heavily on ground stations. So obviously, you cannot get into remote areas or over the ocean. The accuracy is marginal for terminal purposes, at least. It depends upon angular measurements in radars or transponders, and they're generally of the order of degrees, and it ends up with accuracies of several hundred feet when you like to be less than 100 feet to be sure you've isolated an airplane from another one. There is a lack of a common coordinate reference system. The coordinate reference system is the location of the station, which is an accident of economics. Not a design. You have to put an Omni there. That becomes the center of a coordinate system. That means you have to carry offset computers to navigate or fly over these darn things. It tends to channelize you. Voice communication is used quite a lot. It's overtaxed, inefficiently used. The traffic control communication system saturates under high traffic loads. We cannot give equal minimum service to all users. Those who can afford more black boxes get better service. And finally, in order to perform collision avoidance, we'll have to add still another black box and an expensive black box, upwards of $50,000. Now, it's needless to point out that many of our collisions, most of them involve one small aircraft and a big aircraft. And if the small aircraft hasn't got the box, do you have a collision avoidance system? Enough of damning the present. Let's switch to what we think can happen. And of course, we think in terms of the so-called integrated communication, navigation, and identification system, the ICNI system. Let me list some of the reasons why it may be desirable. First, some people think in terms of let's get it down to where one box has the capability of transmitting all the information required, and it's not much. The number of bits required for navigation traffic control is darn few, like one for navigation, and on the average about 10 for traffic control. Peaks sometimes, but on the average it's pretty low. Another group of people think the purpose of an integrated navigation system is to get a single waveform, and they've been waveform crazy, if I may use that expression. They try to focus on how to get a fancy modulation and end up with a very complicated system. A third group of people say we need this because we want global coverage by appropriate stations, probably in space. A fourth group are space cadets. They like to use space for any purpose at all and say, space is the answer. What's the question? Finally, there's a group who feels that by doing this integrated, we can save cost. I think they're all sort of valid. But anyway, if one builds a system which requires every airplane to carry a transmitter, which, say, just sends its identity maybe once every 10 seconds, though its rate can change as you get to more dense terminals. It sends its identity as a number. That's received in four satellites, sent to the ground, and by inverse Lorentz or time of arrival, a position is associated with that identity. The correlation is simple because the identity correlates with itself. So it's not a difficult computation job. Then this position, and incidentally includes altitude, and the altitude is accurate, no matter how high you are, this then can be sent back to a cheap user by sending to the nearest ground station this position and sending to the airplane on his VHF receiver as a little digital message as a subcarrier his position. It is possible to build relatively cheap systems which can serve the basis for automating traffic control. One advantage of a system like that is it would reduce the number and size of the black boxes, thus permitting some aircraft to have more than one. In other words, redundancy becomes possible. It would permit a few but adequate antenna installations. It would conserve RF spectral space. The digital message is just about as an efficient use of the space as one can find. It would furnish the necessary navigation accuracy to permit higher density traffic. It would furnish reliable identity and navigation in digital form. The airborne equipment would be quite inexpensive. $500 ought to be a lead pipe cinch. It would furnish identical services to all users, and it would furnish collision avoidance to all users. It would avoid frequent channel switching, which is one of the bugaboos of the present system. And it could, by simple digital messages, and therefore reduce voice communication. Well, that in brief is the way I think that we should proceed in the 70s, that I think that the advantages of the ICNI are such that careful consideration must be given to this versus the Alexander Report, which proposes a system which they say will saturate eventually, but which would be like an interim system, but supposedly available sooner than the satellite system. I think that if you really want to go, you can get a satellite system pretty fast. The problem will be the evolution into the system, and that involves a long overlap period where the old users use the old system, while new users come in and gradually start using the new.
Harry Davis has just described what may be the ultimate air traffic control system. Dr. Robert Cannon of the Department of Transportation explains the rationale behind the approach currently being followed by FAA.
I'd like to begin with a couple of axioms that are kind of pertinent. The first one is, when you have a highly complex and highly critical job that you have to do and it has to be done right, you don't go about it only one way. It's another way of saying you don't put all your eggs in one basket. The second axiom is that the non-technical community, which includes those that control all the money, quite reasonably assumes that if you're still arguing over alternative technical routes, you must not yet be ready to start. If we don't start presenting a solid front on this business of air traffic control, we aren't going to have any air traffic control system. You all know the statistics. The traffic conservatively estimated to double by 1980, to double again by 1995. Air traffic control requirements, more like triple by 1980, triple again by 1995. Moreover, the risks of collision go up as the square of the amount of traffic. But note in this connection that the number of collisions that occur between aircraft, both of which are under control, has now almost vanished. Now, we can't imagine, and we should imagine, and Harry has imagined, a very elegant system, which might well be in being in a reasonably short time. In the meantime, however, we have got a crisis, and we've got to solve it year by year, month by month. Are there going to be some people killed? We've got the lives of tens of thousands of people on our hands. The FAA, arm of our department, takes that responsibility very, very seriously. They are not about to make any move that does not have a very low technical risk and immediate applicability. So we have the 1980 system as a goal, such as Harry has described. We do need to figure out how to get there from here. Now, there are some disadvantages with the system he's described as well. Disadvantages that have been pointed out are, first, that indeed all your eggs are in one basket. You're going to have a substantial amount of redundancy in order to provide the necessary reliability. Second, the system is vulnerable. Anybody with enough money to put up a reasonable-sized antenna can completely screw up the whole system, as I understand it. The main problem, however, is that the system is not already in being. The in-between system, the one proposed for implementation by the Air Traffic Advisory Committee, which was headed by Ben Alexander, and is conceived of as an extension of the present system. It is, in the minds of the creators of the report, a flexible extension, one which by no means prohibits or hopefully even inhibits the rapid proceeding along the direction of a satellite system with all possible haste. We're now in our second generation system. This is the one that Harry described the genesis of. We are beginning to move into operational status, a third generation system, which involves a degree of semi-automation at the control centers. The Alexander report addresses what they call an updated third generation system to emphasize the fact that it uses present components, but much improved. The first improvement is in the form of a scanning beam microwave ILS system. The second improvement is in the beacon system, as Harry alluded, which would involve not only a transponder, but a data link, sending altitude information to the ground, as in the present, and receiving control commands from the ground by data link rather than by voice. The principal duties of this improved beacon would be, in addition to direct control, to provide automated advisories so that advisories would be present at all times, to provide intermittent positive control as a mode of collision avoidance and possibly as a means of updating the onboard navigation systems. The third piece of hardware central to the system is the development of increased levels of automation in the control process. And the committee envisages improving automation at the maximum possible rate and to the maximum possible degree. Now, I suggest that with the possible exception of the beacon, these systems are all essential parts of the most advanced system we can think of, the automation, because this is clearly central to any overall traffic system. Although the form may be different, much of the software and indeed much of the hardware will be the same. The microwave ILS, I believe, is a necessary part of the system Harry describes for the simple reason that you don't do things only one way. The system does envisage improving the VOR DME system to handle en route traffic. I personally feel a little flexible about that at this point. If we can find a different way to do en route control that provides the additional accuracy and better coverage that Harry has described, I think we should go that route. The committee predicts that with deployment of the above system, plus the traffic pattern improvements that such a system will make possible in the terminal areas, we will indeed double airport capacity with a decrease in noise level. We will improve the freedom of flight through the sky, and we will increase traffic handling without increasing the number of controllers. Improvements that are made possible by this system in traffic patterns include, of course, the dual lane runways, reduction in separation, curved path approaches, which are very important, which allow you to come in off the water, which allow you to come in at steeper bank angles and to adjust your patterns to your neighborhood. And finally, an automated vectoring service. The main problem, of course, is one of the likelihood that we've underestimated the traffic. And this is a system that will surely saturate in time, and maybe in a shorter time than has been computed, and that's serious. Well, our plan in the department is first to proceed at once with the upgraded third generation system R&D, as I've described. Second, to proceed at once with studies of increasingly higher levels of automation. Third, to invest as heavily and urgently as we can in R&D for the fourth generation system, whatever it may be, and Harry has described a very obvious candidate. Fourth, to stay flexible both in the direction in which we move and in our downstream decisions, to move ahead in an evolutionary way. Returning again to Axiom 2, let me say that we've got to present a solid case, a solid technical case for moving ahead at once. We've got to present a solid case for maintaining a flexible posture, and this is not easy to do. We must maintain ample provision for continuing technical review at the strongest technical levels. And finally, we've got to present a solid case for a major R&D investment, not just a deployment investment. I solicit the support of the whole technical community in presenting the solid front. We've got to have it because we've got to move.
Let's leave the session briefly for an IEEE Soundings editorial. For those listeners to whom the alphabet soup of the aviation field is unfamiliar, we strongly recommend Gordon Friedlander's papers in the June, July, and August 1970 issues of the IEEE Spectrum. We think that you will find joint study of the articles and this tape will make both more interesting. We now like to try to reduce the various air traffic control system components to electrical engineering terms. to put the various schemes into a different perspective. A limited number of basic principles is used in air traffic control and air navigation. They are old and familiar ones to most electrical engineers. The most common principle is that of radar ranging. Most air navigation position measurement is done by the transmission of a pulse, its reflection from an object, and interpretation of the transit time delay as wave travel at the velocity of light. Radar direction finding makes use of this principle with a highly directional antenna, which locates the object to within an angle of the order of the antenna beam width. By reflecting waves from a transponder, that is a device which turns around, amplifies, and rebroadcasts a received signal, it is possible to code the return signal so as to identify the object. This scheme is used in several ways. Distance measuring equipment, that is DME or TACAN, on an aircraft transmits a pulse from a non-directional antenna. The signal is received, amplified, and returned from a fixed location ground station. The time delay tells the pilot his distance from the ground station. If he can simultaneously contact two such ground stations, his location is fixed by triangulation. But of course, he must make a calculation with respect to a map or a grid coordinate system to know just where he is. A somewhat similar principle is used for long-range navigation via the Loran system. In this system, which is set up to aid intercontinental navigation, the aircraft receives transmissions from two high-powered Loran stations, one a master, the second a slave, whose transmission is synchronized to that of the master. The difference in time between the receipt of the two signals defines the difference in distance from the two stations. Points of constant time difference in a planar geometry lie along hyperbolically shaped paths. When two Loran signal pairs are received, location can be calculated to better than 1 mile accuracy. Radar principles are also used in radio altimeters, which measure the vertical distance from the aircraft to the ground. By using the Doppler effect, that is, by determining the shift in carrier frequency of the reflected signal, the aircraft can also determine its velocity with respect to the ground. Knowing the airspeed from onboard airspeed measurements, the velocity of the winds aloft can be determined. And finding the course from a magnetic or gyro compass, it is possible to integrate the motion to predict position at later times. The other principles used in air navigation aids depend mainly on the use of antenna directivity patterns. In the instrument landing system, or ILS, fixed high-frequency antennas located precisely with respect to an approach runway send out multi-lobed antenna patterns. The patterns are modulated so that modulation frequencies of 90 Hz or 150 Hz become dominant when the receiver veers to one side or the other of the desired approach direction. Two entirely separate transmitter systems at different carrier frequencies provide glide path, that is, angle of descent, and localizer, that is, azimuth angle from the runway as an axis. Two coordinated receivers in the aircraft drive an integrated instrument in the cockpit. Additional vertically directed antennas, located along the approach, give an indication to the aircraft of its distance from the end of the runway. Microwave ILS systems for the future will permit sharper beam definition and minimize the uncluttered ground area required for such installations. Antenna patterns are used in a different way in the VHF Omnirange or VOR transmitters. The carrier frequency of these units is radiated omnidirectionally, hence the name, but a 30-cycle sideband radiation is produced in a rotating, heart-shaped pattern. The aircraft receiver can tell its bearing, as seen from the VOR station, by the receipt time of the null of the rotating antenna pattern with a time marker modulation broadcast omnidirectionally. Here the time measurement concept is used to obtain an angular measurement. Again, by receiving simultaneously from two such stations, one can obtain a precise location for the aircraft, albeit with a certain amount of charting or computation. The comment earlier by Harry Davis pointed out that VOR stations are located in a more or less random set of sites, which were those available and with the necessary freedom from necessary obstructions. Any automatic triangulation calculation therefore requires the locations of each of the stations to be fed into the onboard computer so as to establish the reference system. Without such equipment, the simplest navigation will take one directly over the VOR stations. This clearly leads to heavy use of limited amounts of airspace. Instrument landing systems are installed on some runways of the major airports in the U.S. More are being installed, but they still number in the few hundreds. A network of VOR stations, many of which also have a distance-measuring transponder, covers the United States in a dual net of low- and high-power stations intended for short-range low-altitude and long-range high-altitude flight navigation, respectively. Frequencies are scattered to reduce the likelihood of mistaking one VOR station for another. Equipment at the major airports and at other control centers can be very complex. As the Friedlander article describes, some ground systems are now highly automated, and automation is being further increased. These systems today, however, must do their actual traffic controlling by passing verbal messages to aircraft pilots, hence the saturation of the voice channels. The entire spectrum of existing air navigation aids falls into several classes. First, devices in the aircraft for use by the pilot or navigator and requiring no ground equipment, for example, the radio altimeter. Inertial navigation gear also falls into this class. Second, devices on the ground, which are simple transmitters or transponders for use by the aircraft in determining its own location, for example, VOR, DME, and ILS. Third, devices on the ground which may or may not require an automatic response from the aircraft, for example, radar and identification transponders. There is sufficient radio transmission using all of the various aids to permit redundant location of an aircraft en route, even with fairly minimal avionics equipment. Aircraft with onboard computers and/or inertial navigation devices have an even more redundant and largely automatic system. The various ground-based systems are grouped into long-range, shorter-range, and terminal area equipments with increasingly greater capability for accurate positioning. But as Harry Davis has pointed out, a full equipment complement represents a staggering array of transmitters, receivers, computers, and instrument displays, all of which require some form of attention and interpretation by the pilot. And these equipments, in most cases, operate independently of one another. There are obviously, from human factors points of view, some major decisions to be made. Is it, for example, safest to relieve the pilot from most of the navigation and flight control tasks, or does this encourage inattention and, in effect, make his skills of less use? What is the right level of flight automation for each class of vehicle? Going beyond the air-to-ground and ground-to-air control and communications activities, growing air traffic has increased the probability of mid-air collisions. Whereas other avionic control functions increase linearly with the amount of traffic, the air-to-air collision avoidance problem does indeed increase as the square of traffic volume. The schemes for collision avoidance currently under development in industry are air-to-air schemes and essentially independent of ground facilities. Each aircraft transmits a series of pulses which are either picked up by other aircraft, in systems where synchronism is maintained by all aircraft, or transponded by other aircraft. Radar ranging and Doppler-derived closing rates define potentially dangerous situations. The pilot is given automatic instructions on a simple panel instrument. The alternative, integrated system, ICNI, relying on pickup of identification signals by satellite or ground stations, can perform collision threat calculations on the ground and transmit instructions only to those craft which must take evasive action. Such an integrated system clearly has less avionics investment per aircraft, but depends critically on the ground and/or satellite systems. Both systems will require special equipment installation in every aircraft. The sooner a workable standard can be selected, the sooner implementation can begin. You have come to the end of Side 1. To continue, electronics in commercial aviation, simply stop the machine and turn your cassette to Side 2.